Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
This is a podcast from The Times. Go to thetimes.co.uk.
The Rugby World Cup from The Times with Mark Suster.
We'll be with you every week with the latest from the tournament, looking at the prospects for the home nations and the other big guns, of course, and reviewing all the action on and off the field.
Find it at thetimes.co.uk or in iTunes.
Welcome to the Game Podcast, a football podcast that would never throw away a two-goal lead. Today I'm joined by Stuart Robson, Peter Lansley, and of course, Alison Rudd. Later on we'll be debating the ridiculous footballers on drug stories, but first, we have some amazing action to cover. Alright, how about we start at Old Trafford? Stuart, this is the best ever start for Sir Alex Ferguson as manager of Manchester United. We always used to say, oh, look, United start slowly. Now they're not starting slowly. Does this mean that they're scarily good?
They are playing very well in an attacking sense. They've got their signings in early. They're playing a very open game. Their fullbacks are getting high up the field. They've got a good system about playing out from the back. The front players are linking up well. You know, it hasn't always been Hernandez. It was Welbeck that started the season in terrific form. Obviously, they've got energy in midfield areas. But I still think they've got problems defensively. And I think that over the course of the season, they will be caught out if they play this system for too long, because the fullbacks play so high when they give the ball away. They're so open to the counter-attack. Even against Benfica. Benfica, I didn't think were a particularly good side, still had opportunities to score against Manchester United. Chelsea had lots of opportunities to score against Manchester. Even Arsenal, losing 8-2, had lots of opportunities to score against Manchester United. Yes, they're playing very well, but I still think they've got defensive problems, particularly in that central midfield area.
Gab, can I come in there? Because I totally agree with that, and it's exhilarating. There's a zest about their play. But when your holding midfielder is Anderson, he's not exactly going to sit and mind the shop too much, is he? He's a creator. He's someone who you might have imagined would be playing in the hole, the way he sprays the passes and everything. But I think it just makes it all the more entertaining, doesn't it?
Alison, I will now make a reading from the book of Kay, Ollie Kay, that is. Journalism is about telling the readers who, what, where, when, why, and how. With that in mind, Manchester United beat Chelsea 3-1 at Old Trafford yesterday afternoon. But explaining why and how the scoreline ended up like that will require rather more telling. You agree with that? Was this one of those nutty games that could have finished, you know, 8-5?
I don't think it was that nutty. I think people are saying it was a basket case sort of football because the defenders, as Stuart was saying, the defenders, Manchester United defenders, they just bomb forward. I mean, when Ferguson signed Phil Jones, I think people thought, yeah, you know, he could grow to be quite a mature, you know, defender. He seems to read the game quite well. No one expected him to be part of almost every attack, and Chris Smalling as well. When he was at Fulham, I saw him and I thought he was almost quite a tentative player. And suddenly they're all that's why people are calling it nutty, because Manchester United are getting players in attacking positions who A, have no history of doing it, and B, from a formation point of view, is sort of it's just not going by the book. It doesn't fit.
What Manchester United are doing, they're making the pitch massive. When they've got the ball, their fullbacks play high and wide, the wingers play high and wide. Hernandez is trying to make runs in behind. There's a little bit of space that Rooney can come off in. The centre halves drop deep to start the play and go round the back. That's great when they've got the ball and it's making it difficult for the opposition to stop them playing, but when they lose the ball, they're also open to the counter-attack.
Okay, but
all that is true, and the reason it wasn't 4-4 is because Chelsea just were not clinical. Exactly what should have happened did happen. United were open at the back. Chelsea exposed that, but did not finish.
Okay, but I'm interested in this concept. But before we get to Chelsea, is this by design? Is this some kind of paradigm shift where, you know, Sir Alex is playing a new type of football where they're more attacking by design? Or is there maybe a flaw there? And you know, Phil Jones and Smalling and are very good individually. But let's not forget, you know, United's starters, or the people who were the starters last season, who I think are still pretty good, aren't there. There's no, you know, the real Darren Fletcher isn't in midfield, not yet anyway. And Peter, the United have conceded, I saw this incredible stat, they have conceded more shots on goal than any other team in the Premier League. The whole point of defending is to not allow the opposition to shoot on goal, right?
Yeah, that's right. It depends where they're shooting from a little bit, I suppose. But I think he's assessed what he's got. And with, you know, Ferdinand perhaps, you know, coming towards the end of his career, he's having to throw in the youngsters of Smalling and Jones alongside Johnny Evans, who's not the most experienced. I think it's just the old adage of attack is the best form of defence. Like you say, Darren Fletcher's not back to his best. Carrick, who's a more cautious playmaker than Anderson, isn't perhaps good enough to get in that side anymore. So it's just like, we're going to score more goals than you. And the way it's going, I mean, that's a fantastic trend. If they can keep that up and they're winning games 4-2 or 3-1 or whatever, then that's a great thing for football, isn't it? We'd like it to go that way.
But the greatest sides, the sides that go on and win, not just the Premier League, go on and win in Europe and go on and be top sides for many, many years, get the balance right between the attacking play and the defensive play. Barcelona have been the top side recently, not just because they play expansive football and they've got great movement and excellent passing ball. It's because they also defend very well from the front and they press the ball and they stop the opposition playing. If Manchester United allow the opposition to counter-attack them, and there's several reasons I think they're doing that. I don't think it's by design. I think Rooney doesn't work hard enough as the forward, the player behind the main striker. He's got
to
be a midfielder.
Sorry, did somebody just criticise Wayne Rooney's work rate?
Yes, I did, yeah.
Are we allowed to do that?
You certainly are. I mean, last year they lost at the Emirates because Wayne Rooney didn't work hard in midfield, and Arsenal created a 3-2. If he's going to play at the top of a midfield, or the holding, the withdrawn striker, he has to work hard in a defensive game. He has to go and close down the holding midfield player for the opposition to allow whoever it may be, Anderson and Fletcher, to go 2v2 in the middle of the park. And then Evra now doesn't want to recover quite so quickly. His recovery runs against Benfica were astonishing. I couldn't believe that he didn't get absolutely rollocked at the end of the game for the way he recovered, not just for the goal, but in other situations. So there's certain aspects of Manchester United's play that still isn't good enough defensively.
Stuart, I want to come back on that Rooney one, if I may, because
yes.
I think for years, when he was scoring sort of 12 goals a season, he was working his gonads off, quite often like left of an attacking three or whatever, and he was doing the doggy runs up and down, and we were saying, hang on a minute, he's one of Manchester United's most creative, one of England's, well, England's best player. Let's free him up. Let's take the workload off his shoulders so that he can score more goals and create more. Now, what you said about making the pitch big, I totally agree with, makes the hole in which their best player can receive the ball
absolutely
bigger. So he's got more space. He scored 9 goals. He's in the best form of his
absolutely
career.
I agree entirely. But what he has to do is when the opposition get the ball, and I'm not talking about him racing 40, 50 yards, that sort of work, right? I'm talking about just moving 5, 10 yards just to stop the holding midfield player for the opposition starting to run the game. And that's what, when he wants to do it, he'll do it very well. He'll still be a brilliant player. At times, he gives the ball, or if Manchester United give the ball, he switches off, and that's when the opposition start to take control of the midfield. I'm talking about 5-10 yards run and being alert, and that's the same with any forward player. When you give the ball away, you have to put yourself in a position to make it hard for the opposition to play past you.
Let's go forward. Well, let's look forward for United now, because I think there's enough talent in United, certainly at the back, in midfield, not 100% sure, but I still believe we may see the best of Darren Fletcher, or we may see Phil Jones in midfield at some point when the regulars return, or the guys who were the regulars. We don't know if we should still be calling them that. But does this mean then that United have another level to go to? Does this mean that, you know, if United's defending can obviously be a heck of a lot better than it is, does it mean that once they fix that, if they can be just as devastating at the other end of the pitch, they're going to be right up there with the very best sides in the world and maybe the very best sides that Sir Alex has ever had.
Yeah, no, I think that probably yesterday, the match on Sunday was the worst that you'll see Man United play, I suspect, which is very, very scary. Their goalkeeper is only going to get better. Vidic has to come back. You know, they are only going to get better.
Peter, let's talk some Torres, shall we? James Ducker gave him a 6. And to be fair, I think it's one of those situations where it's a bit hard to rate the player because his movement was very good. He had a great finish for his goal, I thought. But yeah, he missed not just the one, you know, absurd sitter, but he missed the other one. So are these signs that he's turned the corner?
Yeah, I think so. I think basically in parts of yesterday's game, he was 8 out of 10, and in parts of yesterday's game, he was 4 out of 10. Hence, 6 is about justifiable. But you're right, his movement was much better. And even when he went the wrong way, you know, in the first half when he got that pass from Anderson, a misplaced pass, and cut back onto his right, the movement was still surprising and devastating, even if he scuffed the shot. And then, of course, the miss, the horrible miss, which is described as missing an open goal, was created because his movement to Ramirez's pass was absolutely split-second perfect. And the little step over was fantastic to fool De Gea. And then, of course, the horrible finish. But those are signs that things are turning. And he now knows if he runs for the team, I know it's a bit sort of prosaic, but if he keeps making fantastic runs and links up with his, then it will come back. I think he started to believe that, and that is how you turn the corner.
Going forward, is Torres part of the solution? Because I'm looking, I mean, this has been a talking point all season, you know, which three guys does he play up front? I think everybody agrees, please jump in if you disagree, that Mata should be one of the three up front. Mm-hmm. But, you know, it's pretty much open season on the others. I thought Anelka looked much, much better than Sturridge when he came on. You have Didier Drogba to come back. You have the big man, Romelu Lukaku, who looks terrifying for the opposition. And there's Torres. Allison, are we?
Well, do you build the team around Torres? That's what he's got to decide.
No, that's not what he decides. We know who decides that. Well, that's already been decided, and that's why Mata's there.
But yeah, but what the second half showed was that if you feel you have to build the team around Torres, and
then you should play Anelka.
Then you don't play Lampard, and you play three very attack-minded players behind Torres, so he's getting service from all over the place, and everyone's going chip, 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 and it's just lovely. It's just lovely, and all you need is the old Torres back, and it's sorted, isn't it?
Yeah,
what,
Peter,
would you go back to 4-2-3-1 then, Alison, for Chelsea?
Well, they looked, I mean, I think so. I would be tempted now, if I was in charge, I'd be tempted to say, really big up what happened in the second half.
So would you ask Lampard to play in a different position, or would you ask Lampard to play a position where he sits on the bench?
Well, that's right. If you're going to go to that shape, I think you leave Lampard out, don't you? Unless you just accept he's going to hold. But then that takes away what Lampard's best at.
And he doesn't want to do it anyway, he says.
No.
But I wanted to ask the qualified referee here about Ashley Cole on Chicharito. Now, it's a two-part question. It looked to me like he was not going in, I mean, with the intention to hurt him. He still should have been booked. It looked to me like he was trying to block the shot. But what I don't get is if the referee calls a yellow, it's because he's seen a foul. It's in the penalty box. Should that have been a penalty, or is there some quirk to the laws of the game?
No, I don't understand. And I think a few pundits mentioned it. Maybe they didn't mention it very clearly. But if the ball's out of play when the foul takes place, which was what happened, then you can book the player for dangerous play. But you don't have to give a free kick because the game's dead.
Hang on, didn't Ashley Cole bring him down as he shot?
No, the ball, if you look at it in slow-mo, the game was dead at that point. The ball had gone.
But that's because Chicharito got to the ball first.
I'm going to rewind Match of the Day 2 now and just get to that point, because I'm sure that...
Ooh, do it while I'm talking to you. That'd be good.
Pardon?
Do it now.
I'm doing it now. Good. I've got it on times 30, so...
Although in a way it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter what you see.
Oh, climb back.
It doesn't matter what you see, because it's what the referee and his officials thought they saw.
Okay, but if he did, then he, well, then should have
been
the point.
It is a relevant point. I mean, if it was in the act of shooting, as Peter says, it should have been a penalty.
Well, they took a judgment that that moment had gone. That moment had passed. The ball was no longer in play. There was no longer a threat on goal. He'd tried. He'd failed.
Peter, you good with the Cole Chicharito thing yet?
Yeah, I've got it here, yeah.
And is Alison right?
I think she must be right in that that is the way the officials perceived it. But it's rot. I've got it on hold. Alison's point isn't rot. The decision is rot.
So from Old Trafford to White Hart Lane, I have to say, Spurs beating Liverpool 4-0, I tweeted that this was, after the first half, this was possibly Liverpool's worst 45 minutes of the season, or worst 45 minutes under Dalglish. And I was inundated, absolutely inundated, by Liverpool fans saying, take the possibly out. This was absolute rubbish. This was the worst 45 minutes in the history of the universe. Alison, you weren't one of the Liverpool fans who tweeted me, but it was pretty dire, and it didn't get any better, did it?
No, and it was interesting. I haven't seen a game between two teams that are supposedly high quality and both with ambitions to getting into the Champions League next season. I've never seen a game of supposedly that high quality where from about the third minute it was perfectly clear how it was going. And there was a huge gulf in class and application, and it was almost difficult to comprehend what was going on. Liverpool did look like they'd mixed up the time of kickoff, and they'd all just had steak, chips, and trifle, and were kind of shocked to be there and to be surprised when you go to Spurs. By the way, they, you know, Spurs play a certain way at home. They have loads of pace, and when they play well, you know, they have their spasms of 20 minutes or so. Spurs in every match at home. Their problem, I think, is not being able to sustain it, and sometimes looking a bit wobbly later in a game. But Liverpool did not look like they knew what the hell was going on, and it was peculiar, very very peculiar. And Kenny said, "I don't know why we started so badly." Okay. He has
Kenny
no idea why.
Know. Rudd doesn't know. Does Robson know? Why were Liverpool so bad?
They didn't earn the right to play right from the kick. In every football game, you have to earn the right to play. You have to, you know, win the battle. You have to make sure that you play a level or a tempo that gets you on top of the game before you can start passing the ball with ease. What Liverpool wanted to go out and do was pass the ball with ease right from the kickoff. They went from the kickoff, they went back to Carragher. Carragher had to rush it back to Reina, who kicks it, and then Reina kept on rolling it out to their centre halves and their fullbacks. Tottenham kept on pressing, and from that moment on, they were in trouble. And Tottenham's movement, Tottenham's passing was excellent. The midfield three of Liverpool couldn't cope. They were able to get the ball out to the right back with ease, Tottenham. Then when they tried to close that down, they created an overload in central midfield. The front players kept on coming back from Tottenham and creating another overload in midfield. I looked at Liverpool and I thought they looked like a team that hadn't had any game plan before they went out there. They thought they could play at their own tempo, and you can't ever do that.
But
you have to earn the right to play.
Stuart, but I agree with you completely, but why would anyone, let alone a top club, go to White Hart Lane and almost forget what Spurs can do.
Had they only
watched the Man City
That's what I would worry about. If I was a Liverpool supporter or anybody, I would say, what was the management doing before the game? What were they telling the players? You've got Andy Carroll in your side, you've got Suarez in your side. For the first 15 minutes, let's get it into the front players and play from there. Let's force Tottenham back, and then when we get on top of the game, then we'll start playing through midfield and controlling the game. But if you try and control the game from your own half, and Tottenham press the ball and keep winning it back, you're asking for trouble. And they didn't learn their lesson. After 5 minutes, Kenny Dalglish should have been out to the side of the pitch and said, don't play out from the back, get it into the front players, let's start playing from there, let's bypass Tottenham's midfield. If they're going to press us high up the field, there must be space in behind them. Let's get it up to Carroll, then we'll play from there. But nothing was done, and they carried on playing tippy-tappy football in their own half. They kept on losing the ball, and Tottenham couldn't believe their luck.
Lanzi, we point out Liverpool's flaws. I just thought that Dalglish, maybe like me, didn't think Spurs were any good and thought, oh, we'll just pass circles around them because it's Tottenham. But I don't know. There might be more to it than that. But it was obviously an awful performance. Obviously, all credit to Spurs. But what interested me is we saw 4-4-2 here with Jermaine Defoe off of Adebayor. What I wonder is, what's the implication here, if any, for Mr. Van der Vaart? And you think they'll play 4-4-2 the rest of the year?
Well, I think Scott Parker's key to all this, isn't it? Because that's going to give Harry Redknapp the confidence that someone will... I know he can drive forward, etc., but he knows how to hold properly, doesn't he, Parker?
Does he?
I think so,
who
yeah.
Was it? Well, we had Parker in the England game. Who was on that week? Do you remember, Skinner? They were absolutely slaughtering Parker.
I was on the show, and I think Paddy was giving Parker a terrible time.
But, yeah, sorry.
I thought he was all right.
So, go up. So, well, if it is 4-4-2, I mean... And it is Defoe and Adebayor, you know, those two guys up front, Adebayor and Pavlyuchenko, maybe, whatever. If Parker's obviously in there, Modric, does it mean Modric goes back to playing wide? Would he play wide on the right? Or does Van der Vaart go wide? How does he make it fit?
I think looking at that formation, obviously Bale have to play and you have to let him go. And I think you would... Van der Vaart would have to compete with Kranjčar there and play tucked in on the wide, on, you know, narrow wide right, because you've got Kyle Walker bombing on outside him. And then also Adebayor, I didn't watch that game in detail, but Adebayor will probably, you know, he likes to roam, doesn't he? He likes to go and sort of pop up in unusual places like Kana used to. And then that Van der Vaart might be able to interchange with that.
If I'm Van der Vaart, after what I did last year, I look at my pedigree. I expect
Van der Vaart
to start
was a problem
game
for Tottenham last year. He played well when they had the ball, but I saw games where Van der Vaart played in the hole behind, and like I was talking about Rooney earlier on, Van der Vaart played in the hole and they had someone like Crouch or Pavlyuchenko up in front of him. When the opposition had the ball, Van der Vaart couldn't defend, so the opposition started to dominate midfield, and that was a problem for Harry Redknapp. How do I fit Van der Vaart in the team? Van der Vaart was a problem, particularly away from home. Yes, at home when they're dominating the play, he could play in the hole, he could drift all around the field. Away from home, he didn't really want to play Van der Vaart because he was a liability defensively.
Isn't it much simpler just to drop Defoe and bring him off the bench, or not bring him off the bench?
Well, no, Defoe played well yesterday.
Yeah, but he played.
Hi, I'm Jane Garvey.
And I'm Fee Glover.
Off Air with Jane and Fee is going live.
We are taking to the stage at the amazing Crucible Theatre in Sheffield on Friday, the 31st of May.
It'll be a night full of surprises. We'll have a special guest, we'll involve you in the audience, and we'll embarrass ourselves. You really won't want to miss it.
Well, the surprise is we don't yet know what's in it, so it genuinely is a night of surprises.
Well, you've surprised me already. It's not just us. Our live show is part of an exciting new podcast festival called Crosswires, which is taking place in some really amazing venues across Sheffield from the 31st of May to the 2nd of June.
So other podcasters that you'll be able to see include Katie Price, Catherine Ryan, Ramesh Ranganathan, and the original Adam Buxton. But there's also a whole host of free fringe events, family shows, surprise acts, and after parties that Jane and I haven't yet been invited to.
I'm sure it's only a matter of time. Head to crosswires.live for tickets and more information.
Well, first of all, yesterday, given the way Liverpool played, I mean, I think this cup of tea could have played well, you know, and been rather effective. But I don't know, I just find it interesting that Defoe scores a goal, and then all of a sudden it's taken for granted that he is one of the starting center forward, or, you know, one of the two starters for Spurs, when, to me at least, in the past 12 months, I don't know that he's done anything to say that, you know, well, yeah, he needs to be in the side.
And Van der Vaart doesn't play that many games, does he? He does tend to get niggles. I don't think he seems to have the best mobility in the world. Like Stuart's saying, don't ask him to defend too much. So if he's going to be coming in and out and he wants to pick his games, well, sure, we'll go with that.
All right, enough Tottenham. The jury's out. We'll see what Harry does and how he copes with his various headaches, as Alison puts them. But let's go to Ewood Park. I know Stuart's gagging to talk about this. Okay, Blackburn and Arsenal. Rovers win 4-3. Big shout out to Steve Keane and Vankies and the rest of the... I mean, I think they have to be like some of the most derided people I think, in recent memory. But they got a big win. Somebody had the foresight to sign the Yak, who scored two goals. And I think, you know, we can all joke about, oh, look at Yakubu, he's so fat and whatever. But, you know, point is, his goals to minutes on the pitch ratio is pretty good. And maybe that's what Blackburn needed. But I want to start with you. This is obviously a game that could have gone either way. Were there just... Have you ever seen Arsenal make this many mistakes? Individual mistakes, team mistakes, tactical errors in a single game?
Yes, I have. And
don't say last week.
No, I've seen them make lots of mistakes defensively. They're still not a particularly good defensive side. The creative side of the game is excellent. And what we were talking about, Manchester United, you have to get the balance right between attacking play and defensive play. And at the moment, Arsenal aren't defending well enough. I mean, they created so many opportunities, even in the last 20 minutes when they're slinging the ball into the box, things you don't expect of Arsenal. Some of the crossing was magnificent. And Mertesacker got onto the ball. Šamac scores with his head. Arsenal looked dominant when they were crossing the ball into the box. But defensively, there were so many things wrong. You know, the first goal, many pundits, I was listening to pundits saying, oh, well, the other two, Koscielny should squeeze up and so should Santos. No, the first problem was, if Mertesacker gets back from the position where he was a little bit too high and gets back and recovers into diagonally into a good line, Yakubu doesn't get in behind them. Then when he doesn't get into a good line, Koscielny should play like a sweeper and see the danger and cover round. That was the first mistake. Then they there's nothing wrong with zonal marking, but Blackburn were very clever. They put Yakubu, not Yakubu.
Alan Shearer doesn't like zonal marking.
Oh well, that's definitely one way not to go then. So Samba played one side, and Zonzi the other good header of the ball, and they just kept on missing Mertesacker out. So Mertesacker didn't, the big Arsenal player that's good in the air, he didn't head the ball once when it came into the box because Blackburn kept on playing away from him.
Peter, this is Arsenal's worst start in 58 years. Will this be the worst season in 58 years?
Well, I don't think they're likely to win anything. I don't think Arsene Wenger is a man who looks like he's in control of the situation. They've obviously lost two of their very best players, and asking Aaron Ramsey to come in and be Cesc Fabregas now, has he turned 20 yet, is too big an ask. They're in transition.
Sorry, to be fair to Wenger, I think he's asking Arteta to do the Fabregas job. Right, not Ramsey.
Yeah, okay, yeah. But, I mean...
Spanish, Barcelona, knows the Premier League. I mean, not quite Fabregas, but, you know, kind of like...
Yeah.
Best replacement you can get.
Fair point. And Arteta's class, isn't it? And he will have a bit more authority. But it's not someone who's been in the Arsenal way of things, who's going to come in and be their captain and you know, wear his heart on the sleeve in the same way that Fabregas did when he was at his best for that 3 or 4 years. Basically, I'm trying to get away from the fact I think Wenger's on the way out.
Oh, you're too upset to countenance that, are you, Peter?
Well, I can just imagine all the Arsenal... Well, my neighbour's an Arsenal fan, and I can just imagine them saying, but he's God and he's brilliant and we play beautiful football. And I agree with all that. But I just think he's lost the plot. I just think the whole defensive thing is now almost far... Mind if 13's defended better than that yesterday. And we had 5 minutes working on corners before kickoff.
How'd you do? What was the final score?
It was 4-0.
All right, for you, that's a defensive performance to boast about, conceding four goals.
They were brilliant, I tell you.
Final word on Blackburn Rovers, because, like I said, I mean, it's been open season on them. Just want to have a quick whip round, and I would like you to all give me your percentage chances of the Rovers staying up. Let me take that again. I had the hiccup, sorry. I'm just going to have a quick whip round. I'd like to get your percentage chances of Blackburn staying up. Stuart?
I'm going to go 60% chance.
Ooh, better than 50-50. Alison?
90.
Oh, so such love for the Venkies and Steve Keane. Peter?
40.
40. I'm absolutely shocked.
Wait, well, what's your number then?
It's considerably less. This week we're going to, in our debate this week, this is somewhat on the back of the Dispatch's documentary, which aired last Monday. But I had a lot of problems with it, and you can go look at my Twitter feed with what it was. But I don't want us to just go and tear the Dispatch's crew a new one. I do want to raise the issue of drugs in football. Well, one of the big sticking points and one of the big sort of contentious issues was the issue of recreational drugs. And I want to get into the ethical issue of whether it's your employer's business or whether it's the FA's business. But it's just the fact of, you know, in England, the policy is if you fail a drug test for recreational drugs, they do not make it public. Does anybody see a problem with that, or is it the right approach? Obviously, the filmmakers who made Dispatches had a big problem with it. Stuart?
Well, I come from a coaching point of view. I was disgusted when one of our players was, I didn't realise he'd actually been caught for it before, and then the physio was hiding it because he was letting him have Mondays off. He was saying, he's phoned up and he said he's got flu because he knew the testers were coming in on a Monday, and he was taking cocaine. He was going out on a Saturday night taking cocaine, and I felt cheated as the coach, and the manager felt cheated, and I would say the supporters should feel cheated because he's been paid a good wage, and if you start doing anything that will affect your performance as badly as that would do, then I think it should be out in the public eye.
And it affects your teammates and your opposition. You know, if you're playing against someone whose judgment is enhanced or impaired, altered by a drug, the way you come together on the pitch will be different. You can call before they go on the pitch.
I think
no, but if you are altering your personality or your approach to the game, or it's in your system in any way, that is immoral and therefore has to be publicly known, because that's. You know, I've played football. I have played football at such a low level that various people have been pissed, and they think they're great, and they think, oh, I can carry on running, but it impairs, you know, it's like drink driving. You're a bit slower, so your trackles come in a bit later. Drugs have an impact at some level somewhere, and it will at some point down the line, someone will get an injury because the person they're playing against, they're not who they were because of the drugs.
Peter,
an ex-professional. What was the attitude in the 1980s when, if legend is to be believed, well, it probably still happens now, teammates would be coming in after a good heavy session, maybe Tuesday was the drink day, come into training on Wednesday, and you could still smell alcohol on teammates' breath.
Well, I was absolutely disgusted. I only ever drunk on a Saturday night. I couldn't understand why players. I wouldn't have been able to perform in training if I'd had a drink the night before, because that was my mentality and that was my rule, that I would only drink and not too heavily anyway on a Saturday night, because obviously you had to recover. But I was disgusted, and there was players when I was playing for Arsenal that would come in straight from the night out, and the coach at the time, John Cartwright, who was the first team coach, and I used to be in the car park. We should see them come in from the night out.
So you would accept, Stuart, that it does affect your performance?
Yeah,
not just in terms of,
it
would affect your teammates in training. You might hurt them,
I wasn't actually worried about them hurting me. What I was worried about is that we're trying to become a better team, and part of that is training well. And if your teammates are out getting drunk the night before and coming in still worse for wear, how can you train properly? How can that be good for your body? How can you put in a good performance on a Saturday if you spend most of the
talking
drinking.
About the morals of whether this is public knowledge or private knowledge, if what's been in your bloodstream is going to affect what you do to other people.
Drink is not illegal. Cocaine is illegal. Most recreational drugs are illegal. That's a totally different thing.
Okay, but that's where you get into a whole other territory, whether it's the police's job or it's the employer's job. I mean, certainly, I think just to put the FA's case forward for not making these tests public is they view it as if you test positive for recreational drugs, you have a problem. You know, you've got some kind of condition which prevents you from observing the law. And therefore, just as we wouldn't necessarily make, you know, a drunk driving case public, you know, depending on the circumstances, we will work with you, we will get you help, and so that you can overcome this condition if we're satisfied that you're not doing it to cheat. Lansley, is this a valid argument? Is it an ethical argument?
Well, the FA should be allowed to keep it private.
Yeah, for the reasons that they give.
Should be allowed to keep it private.
Okay. Do you want to have a think about it? I'll ask Alison in the meantime.
Let's draw a parallel. If you are driving along and the police pull you over and you have too much drugs or alcohol in your blood and you go to court, that is automatically public knowledge. If you're at work working in a factory, and the factory decides to do, because they're allowed to, because you've signed some sort of contract of employment, do a blood test and find that you had too high levels in your bloodstream for operating the machinery. That's not the police, that's an internal matter. And then they have to, as a group, as an organisation, they have to decide whether...
What would you do?
You can keep that internal and deal with it internally.
If you were the football manager and one of your players got caught for drugs, would you, not performance-enhancing drugs, recreation drugs, what would you do about it?
Well, it depends who the player is. I mean, in the real world, the real politic world...
It doesn't matter who the player is.
Of course it does, because the player is an asset to the club.
So it would depend on their market value then, Gab. So
in the real world, that's how it works. So if I have Adrian Mutu at my club and I want to get rid of him because I don't like him and because I think he's got a whole raft of problems and he's got a long-term contract, then I make the make it public and I use it as a reason. It is grounds for termination. If it's somebody else who I believe has made a mistake, who I believe is salvageable, then I don't make it public because I'm hurting myself and I'm hurting my employer and I'm hurting my company.
No, you've got two different things there. You were just saying, you know, if they've got a problem, I can help them. Your starting point there was, if they're a really good player and they're really marketable, then I keep it private.
Yes,
if they're rubbish and I want them off the books, then great. Then
well, I don't care what sort of player they are. They have cheated you and your club. And
you're going to cut off your nose to spite your face.
I would, yes, yeah. I would.
So instead of sending Diego Maradona to go and get help, for example, and keeping it under wraps as best you can, although obviously with Maradona it's impossible to keep anything under wraps.
Well, that's a bad example.
But instead of doing that and try to get him treatment and whatever and keep it on the quiet, you would have just said, "Hey, Maradona, go away."
Hang on, you haven't heard.
I'm going to cancel your contract.
No, I'd say we're going to suspend you for 2 months, and I'm going to make it. But we're going to tell the public why you're suspended, and you're going to. We might go and get your help or whatever you're going to do, but we would make it public, and I would suspend him for 2 months.
If I was the owner of the company, I wouldn't want to employ you for that very reason, because your job is to dampen. Your job would depress the value of the assets of my company. And in your analogy with the factory, I think it is a very fair analysis, but it's the factory that tests you, i.e., the analogy here, it's the clubs that test you internally. It's not like there's some, you know, national organization of factory workers who goes and tests every factory worker. And I think you know, that's the big difference there. I actually by the FAA's line about not making these tests public, WADA doesn't require it. I think rightly so. What maybe you could do is, in certain circumstances and with repeat offenders, I think there's a case to be made to be making these cases public. But if it's not a cheating matter, if it's a private matter, I'm kind of comfortable deferring, you know, treating each case on a case-by-case basis.
Depending on how much money that player makes for your club and how much you'll depreciate in value.
Well, it depends who you're talking about. It depends who you're talking about. If it's a test done by the employer, that's how I expect the employer to ask.
I find that an immoral view. Sorry, it doesn't matter.
Have you seen some of the people who own football clubs?
Yeah,
no. I'm talking
from my point of view.
Well, put it this way: I expect the FA and the Premier League to behave according to certain ethical and moral standards. Mm. I don't necessarily expect the clubs to do that, you know, on this type of matter, because the club's job is to look after the well-being of the club. The FA and the Premier League have, you know, a slightly higher, more elevated mission, don't they?
Gab, you're just lining yourself up with the... You're just getting in line with the cheats, with that attitude. You're either underpinning your whole sort of policy, the whole way you live your life, by moral matters or by commercial matters. You can't fudge it. It's one or the other.
No, because there's a personal moral sphere. Let me give you another example about the moral sphere, right? If I own a football club, right, I may have a player whose sexual practices I don't like and I find morally and ethically repugnant, but that's in his private life. Do I have the right to go and sack him for what he does in his private life?
Are they legal or illegal?
Let's assume that they're legal.
Okay, well, I think maybe there's the drawing line for you.
Drugs are illegal.
Right, but the clubs aren't law enforcement. It's not... I mean, the clubs have the right to terminate. No, but what I'm saying is...
Or suspend the player or do whatever you want. If somebody in your charge, in your club, is taking illegal drugs, you have every right to ban them. You have every right to suspend them, fine them.
No. Take a step back. I'm not saying you don't have the right to do that, right? These people sign contracts. They agree to drug testing, right? Policemen also agree to random drug tests as well, right? And rightly so. And I believe in some cases doctors do as well. So I'm not saying the clubs don't have a right to do that. I'm saying they don't have an obligation to go and make their names public.
Do they have the right to then get rid of the player, sell him on without telling the buying club that they have a drug problem?
That's the FA. The FA say that they do because it's a private matter and it's a matter that's helped by treatment. And you're not going to help the player if this fact becomes public.
There is a middle ground. It's not public, but it's known between the buying and the selling club.
Yeah, but you know as well as I do that there's no such thing. I mean, once it's known between the buying and the selling club, you know, that means the agents know, and it's very easy at that point. You know, it will get out.
I think that's the risk someone who takes drugs has to take, isn't it?
I have my duck whistle ready, and that can only mean one thing. It's time for quick hits. Now, before we get into it, I've had a lot of complaints about the duck whistle, how horrible it sounds, how annoying it is. So please, I beg of you, be cooperative. Do not make me use it.
How long do we get?
You get 25 seconds.
Okay.
I'm picturing you in your kitchen with your egg timer. Manchester City blow a two-goal lead away to Fulham and have to settle for a point. Roberto Mancini is getting stick for taking off David Silva in the second half and replacing him with Pablo Zabaleta. Alison, are you going to also blame the negative but very handsome Italian manager?
He's not that handsome.
Relative to other Premier League managers,
okay,
he is.
Granted. I don't think he was being negative. I think Mancini was being sensible. Fulham had scored. The tide had turned. Admittedly, very surprisingly, it didn't look like it could go that way. And City had been playing very attacking, free-for-all football. And Mancini simply thought, oh, I think we need to just be a bit more sensible here, tighten up a little bit, and I'll bring on a defensive-minded player. That's not negative. That's trying to be sensible. And events bore out that maybe he should have been more negative.
Probably a better explanation than the lame excuse of not having enough players that he came up with after the game. It's the usual two sides to Joey Barton. He plays brilliantly in QPR's 3-0 win at Wolves and then taunts opposing fans and gets into a ruckus with Carl Henry at the final whistle. Peter, we better get used to this, right? And was Henry's behaviour a mitigating factor? What are they saying out there in the Midlands?
Well, we had better get used to it. I think Joey Barton, although Newcastle is high profile, he's going to love London, he's going to love the amount of attention he gets. And even this morning on Twitter, he's having a go at someone on 77 followers, having a go at numbnuts and telling him to get 100 followers before he has a go at him. How many times was Joey Barton in the England provisional squad last season? Fewer than Carl Henry. Is Henry's behaviour mitigating? The referee did not blow the whistle for that tackle at the end, so I think we'd better let the ref be judge and jury on that. Joey Barton should shut up.
But I liked his very helpful comments about Match of the Day and how rubbish Lee Dixon was. Honestly, I am so diametrically opposed to his views on what makes a good pundit. I actually quite rate Lee Dixon.
He's the best one, isn't he?
Well, you're asking me to pay favourites there. I'm not going to do that.
Can't be public. That can't be public.
No, you can't say publicly.
Like that. That has to be private.
If he was worth a lot of money, then we'd think about it.
I will show more dignity to respond to that. Sunderland storm back to pummel Stoke 4-0. They even score off set pieces. Stuart, is this a Wearside renaissance, or was it just a case of Stoke not being as good as we thought?
Stoke are only a good team when they play at 100%, when they're fully fit and they've got their minds on the game. They had a long trip away in the Europa Cup. They weren't at the races. They didn't work hard enough. They didn't play at 100%, and that's why they lost the game by 4-0, not because Sunderland was suddenly a good side.
At least they're slightly improving side, given that.
Gab, here's one for you. Real Madrid lost at the weekend. I thought La Liga had become like Scotland. What's happening?
well, yeah, maybe the league is a little more competitive than people realize. Jose Mourinho made a bunch of changes in his team, but, you know, still good players out there. Kaká, Contrao, Di Maria, and against a veteran team like Levante, a very well-organized team. They frustrated them. They just simply couldn't score. It was a bad pitch in the second half. Ronaldo came on. Before that, Di Maria had a Tierney-like hissy fit and threw himself to the ground. A very bad day at the office for the special one. That's all we've got time for this week. But remember, you can go to www.thetimes.co.uk. You'll find your news, your gossip, your analysis. There's also web chats. Mine's on Tuesdays. So until next week, peace out.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Welcome back to Two Judgy Girls. I'm Mary from the Bay.
And I'm Courtney from LA. TJG is the podcast where we spill all the tea on your favorite reality TV shows, celebrity gossip, and everything in between. We're here to bring you our unfiltered opinions, hilarious commentary, and plenty of laughs along the way.
We're two SDSU Delta Gamma sisters with a microphone and a whole lot of opinions. Each week, we dive headfirst into the wild world of reality television, from Bravo to all the trash TV you could want. We break down the drama, dissect the latest scandals, and share our thoughts on everything from the jaw-dropping moments to the embarrassing antics.
But that's not all. We're not here to just gossip. We're here to connect with you, the jurors, and share our love of all things pop culture. Whether we're dishing on the latest celebrity breakups, discussing our favorite guilty pleasure movies, or sharing embarrassing stories from our own lives, we promise to keep it real, keep it fun, and keep you coming back for more.
Come judge with us.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.